Water is Life. Youth speak out on the impacts of fracked gas export. On Thursday, November 16th at 6:30 p.m. at Hevorah Shalom in Portland. Water is Life will include a panel of youth from the Yurok, Hoopa, and Karuk tribes, traveling all the way from Northern California to share their perspective, and a video recently produced by the Klamath tribes in Southeast Oregon, in opposition to the massive proposals to pipe, liquefy, and export fracked gas through the Northwest. Again, that's Water is Life. Youth speak out on the impacts of fracked gas export on Thursday, November 16th at 6:30 p.m. at Hevorah Shalom, 825 Northwest 18th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience, KBOO, Portland.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is poet Ray Armantrout. Armantrout is one of the original members of the Language School of Poetry that emerged in the 1970s and includes the likes of Ron Silliman, Lynn Hajinian, Susan Howe, and Charles Bernstein. Armantrout studied poetry with Denise Levertov, earned a master's degree in creative writing from San Francisco State University, and was a longstanding professor of writing in the literature department at the University of California, San Diego. Armantrout's 14 poetry collections include Next Life, selected as a New York Times notable book, Up to Speed, and Veil, both finalists for the Penn Center USA Award, and Versed, for which Armantrout won the Pulitzer Prize in Poetry and the National Book Critics Circle Award, and which was a finalist for the National Book Award. Armantrout's poetry has been widely anthologized, appearing in Language Poetries from New Directions, Postmodern American Poetry, American Women Poets of the 21st Century, and many editions of Best American Poetry. She is also the author of the prose memoir, True. Ray Armantrout is here today to talk about her two latest books of poetry, the chapbook Entanglements, that collects her poems that engage with quantum physics, and her book Partly, New and Selected Poems 2001 to 2015, both from Wesleyan University Press. The American poet says of Partly, "What marks this enthralling collection is the clarity of thought regarding thoughts that are constitutionally unclear." Armantrout walks us over to what usually cannot be said and finds a way to say it. She helps us spend time with the idea of the reality of a thing being its movement rather than its substance. Steph Burt in the London Review of Books says that Armantrout reminds us that we see only what we have learned to see, what our lives and our societies will let us see, that there is no unmediated nature. Michael Robbins in the Chicago Tribune adds, "For nearly 40 years, Armantrout has made a poetics of not finding the right words, of finding, in fact, the wrong words. Armantrout restores the strangeness of experiences we take for granted." And Grace Cavalieri of the Washington Review of Books exclaims, "Ray Armantrout is back in town. Words are equipment, disassembled and reconstructed to not only make meaning, but to show process of meaning. Call it modernism, postmodernism, constructivism, avant-garde, or a mix. What we encounter are minimalistic, fragmentary structures that make the whole by breaking the whole. Armantrout is funny, witty, wise, and philosophical. The book is a selfie of the mind's kaleidoscope." Welcome to Between the Covers, Ray Armantrout.
Thank you, David. That was very thorough.
Well, let's start with your book, Entanglements, your collection of poems that more than others engage with quantum physics, both its language and its concepts. I think a lot of people might find physics and poetry to be a strange marriage. So I'm curious what draws you to it, and maybe the ways that you see specifically that they might share sensibilities, or the ways in which they diverge that are productive for your poetry.
I started reading popular books on physics sort of by accident. In the 80s, I think it was, I read that book called The Tao of Physics, which a lot of people read, and I found that it made me write. At first, it's, you know, like many people, I found it sort of absurd. And it is, in a way. It's beyond common sense, certainly. But that sort of got me writing. And then I came back around to it in the maybe early 2000s, and I started reading, you know, The Elegant Universe by Brian Greene and books by Lee Smolin and Lisa Randall and other physicists. And the more I read, the more I got puzzled. And I find that when I'm puzzled, that's what starts me going towards a poem. So it's not that I feel that I really understand this stuff. I mean, I'm no mathematician, that's for sure. But it triggers my imagination somehow. And I try to understand it as well as I can, too. Maybe I was attracted to it because I was raised by an evangelical mother. And so I was raised on Genesis. So in a way, that you know, all stories like Genesis tell the story of the beginning and sort of answer the big questions. So I became a skeptic or an agnostic when I was only about 12, which sort of, you know, caused a few problems in my household. But I still remained with those questions, you know, if not God in 7 days, then what, you know, how? And I didn't really have any answers to that. I started trying to make it up for myself. I was 12, you know, I was an arrogant 12-year-old. But so, you know, when I started reading physics, and especially, I guess, at first, cosmology, I felt at home in that way about, you know, it was talking about how things might have started and where the edge of things might be, you know, which is always an intriguing question.
So when you say that puzzlement is the beginning of poetry for you, or mm-hmm. the beginning place where a poem might come from, and you talk again at the end here about coming to the edge of things, it reminds me of the conversation you had with the physicist Brian Keating, and he has you read a Whitman poem called When I Heard the Learned Astronomer, and the poem asserts a fundamentally different relationship to knowledge and wonder between a poet and a scientist. And the poem, I think, raises the question, does knowing more and does naming and classifying what we do know take away or add to an experience? And I was just curious if what your thoughts were about wonder in relationship to knowledge and then in relationship to science and poetry.
And then, of course, there's also that great poem by Emily Dickinson that goes, split the lark and you'll find the music, bulb after bulb in silver rolled, which, of course, is, you know, deliberately absurd. If you split the lark, you won't find the music. You'll find the blood, which she gets around to later. Obviously, I don't feel that kind of antipathy to science. It sparks wonderment in me instead of shutting it down. I mean, admittedly, if I were, you know, a college sophomore in a physics class, I might feel a little bit differently about it. I might feel a little more constrained, but I don't have those constraints. And I do very much respond to nature viscerally, to just seeing nature, which is what Whitman was talking about. And I write about that experience, too. But intellectual wonder and aesthetic wonder can both come into a poem. I don't see why not.
Yeah. And I think that Keating was arguing that there's a lot of wonder in physics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I wonder if one of the differences might be that wonder isn't an end goal, or you're not trying to produce wonder in science.
Right.
Even though it's more like a byproduct of science. Whereas mm-hmm. in poetry, when you talked about when I find something puzzling, that might be the beginning place of a poem, and then moving yourself to the edge of things, you said at the end of that first comment, I wonder if for a scientist, moving to the edge of things isn't to experience wonder, even though that might happen, but it is to know more.
Well, you know, they have to be trying to know more. They have to be trying to find the truth. But on the other hand, I've heard it said, and I can't remember which scientist said it, but some scientist said that the best thought a scientist can have, the most exciting thought a scientist can have, is not eureka, it's, huh, that's funny. Because, you know, when experimental data doesn't conform to your theory, then you know you have work to do. Then you have a project. Right. Then you have a place to go. And that's what's exciting.
Well, I think a lot of listeners who aren't scientists or were averse to science in school are probably familiar with the class Physics for Poets. Mm-hmm. A lot of people in the humanities took classes called Physics for Poets to fulfill a requirement.
Right.
Well, you've taught a class that sort of, forgive the pun, it flips the equation, mm-hmm. and you've taught poetry to physicists.
For physicists. Yeah, yes. It's an exact flip.
Yeah. So what was that like? And I know you've obviously have a long history of teaching poetry to aspiring poets. Mm-hmm. What was the experience like of having a whole bunch of aspiring physicists engaging with poetry?
It was Brian's idea. He wanted to do it all along. And that's one of the ways in which we got together and started speaking to each other. He thought that physics students didn't pay enough attention to language. Eventually, they would have to write and they would have to speak. He's a very good speaker. And they should just pay more careful attention to language, which, of course, is what poetry encourages. And Brian would talk about a particular topic, say the role of the observer in physics, which is, as many of you know, a kind of interesting, vexed, problematic role when it comes to quantum physics. And then I would segue from that to maybe the role of the reader in interpreting poems. And then I would give some examples from poetry and we'd talk about that. Or maybe he would talk about different kinds of symmetry in physics. Mm-hmm. And then I would talk about symmetry in poems. I could have them read Blake's The Tiger that talks about, you know, the fearful symmetry that God has created in producing the tiger. I also showed them Easter Wings, which, you know, produces an actually on-the-page version of a mirror symmetry, but, you know, reproducing the shape of the wings. So, I mean, we kind of matched themes that way, and we would sort of take turns.
Let's hear a couple poems from Entanglement. If we could hear Chirality and Ether.
Sure. Okay, I'll start with the Ether. We're out past the end game where things get fuzzy, less thingy, though in past times we practiced precision, concrete as a slot machine. But to be precise, you need to stop a moment, which turns out to be impracticable, and besides, speed is of the essence. Don't worry, of can take care of itself, and it's fine to say essence now that it's understood to mean ether, a kind of filler made either of inattention or absorption somewhere near the Planck length. Chirality. If I didn't need to do anything, would I? Would I oscillate in two or three dimensions? Would I summon a beholder and change chirality for him? A massless particle passes through the void with no resistance. Ask what it means to pass through the void. Ask how it differs from not passing.
We've been listening to Rae Armantrout read from her latest chapbook, Entanglements. The line in Ether where you say, we're out past the end game where things get fuzzy, less thingy, it makes me wonder if there's something specifically about quantum physics that brings it closer to the world of poetry than other sciences.
Mm-hmm.
The notion of contradiction and paradox and bafflement is something mm-hmm. that most poets are, or many poets are engaging with.
Yeah.
But it seems like it's brought into the fabric of quantum physics in a way that it isn't brought into Newtonian physics or into a lot of biology, for instance, the fact that a wave is also a particle,
mm-hmm.
The
mm-hmm.
duality paradox, or that strings and string theory have a length, but they don't have a height or a width, or that something can be singular and also infinite at
mm-hmm.
the same time. And so it made me wonder if that was part of your attraction around this engagement, and if maybe that's what you're referring to by quantum weirdness when you talk about quantum weirdness in the introduction.
Well, I mean, that quantum weirdness is actually a phrase that physicists themselves use, so I picked it up from that. But your question about why physics would this kind of physics would attract poets, one thing you didn't mention is the way that subatomic particles such as electrons are believed to be in more places than one. It's impossible to specify their location until they're measured or until they interact with another object. So they have, in a way, they have no essential existence. If location is part of existence, they don't have that. They only have potentiality, sort of a potential to exist. And that is a sort of fuzziness, certainly. And you could make a metaphorical connection between that and double or multiple meaning in poetry, sort of a polysemy, I guess, is the technical word, where meanings hover and various meanings are possible. So that's one way to look at it. I'm a little, in this poem, I think, in The Ether, I'm playing out a kind of sense of contradiction myself, because the poets I grew up on and most admired were the imagists such as William Carlos Williams and Ezra Pound, for whom precision was really everything, and they really emphasized the concrete. Williams famously said, "No ideas but in things." Mm-hmm. And yet, now what is a thing? That's getting less and less clear. You know, a thing is material, but what is matter? I mean, when you really take, the closer you get to it, the less matter there is in matter. As most people know by now, atoms are mostly empty space, and then they're made up of these subatomic particles that may or may not really be there at any particular place. So, and then as we know from Einstein, matter is equivalent to energy. So how material is matter? Right? So how thingy is a thing?
Right.
That's kind of where this poem started.
And I think that's another thing that's really interesting about quantum physics is the language seems to nod towards a metaphysics, even when it's not intending to. You have the line, we're out past the end game, and what does it mean to pass through the void in your poems? Mm-hmm. This sense of a contemplation of mortality, which goes back to what you had mentioned earlier about your upbringing in an evangelical mm-hmm. home. And there was something you say that's really great about matter in that essay, Cosmology in Me. It is often said that fundamentalists are literalists. What is seldom said is that they are materialists. Could you talk a little bit about how fundamentalist, or particularly your mother as a fundamentalist, was a materialist and not just a literalist? And then the way you trouble the word materialist in that, the way you sort of just did for us.
Right. I hadn't really thought about that, but I guess I'm in this poem I'm doing some of the same things I did in that essay. Well, I mean, if a fundamentalist, this may be controversial, but takes everything in the Bible literally, then they really resist metaphor. So 7 days means 7 days, even if there was no sun at the time because the earth was created first. So there is a way in which, you know, Jesus had to be resurrected bodily, physically, for it to count. So there's a particular kind of, through literalism, connection into the material world. And maybe in some ways that's what makes Christianity radical and interesting, the idea of the incarnation, that, you know, spirit actually becomes matter. I mean, that can be interesting too. And it's more dramatic, I think, in Christianity than it is in some other religions.
You mentioned in that piece that so fundamentalism is a type of materialism, but like what you just said, we don't actually know what matter is. We know that matter has mass, but what is mass?
Yeah.
And so what you end up doing with a literalist approach to life is to sort of push on it and end up with more questions than answers, which is sort of going against your upbringing in a way.
Right.
And making your very upbringing something strange.
Yes, that's true. I mean, especially in poems, I really prefer to leave questions open. And I mean, I think I grew up in a world where there were a lot of lines of inquiry were foreclosed. And so I'm maybe still, even relatively late in life, rebelling against that, wanting to leave thought open.
Well, let's hear a couple more poems. I was thinking spent and particular would be.
Okay. I'll start with particular. In a way, it's got some kind of connection back to the poems that we were just reading. Particular. Rough, squat, bent, crabbed, cranky. A crank is a person who is overenthusiastic about a particular topic. To be particular is to be choosy. A particle is a body whose extent and internal structure, if any, are irrelevant. You there, let's dispense with these properties of matter, such anachronistic clothes as ghosts wear. Let's be mirrors facing mirrors, fall in love. Spent. Suffer as in allow. List as in want. Listless as in transcending desire or not rising to greet it. To list is to lean dangerously to one side. Have you forgotten? Spent as in exhausted.
We've been listening to Ray Armantrout read from her latest book, Partly, New and Selected Poems 2001 to 2015. Another way that your poetry intersects with science and metaphysics in a less explicit way is around the nature of self. It seems like both in philosophy and in science, there's a division with regards to whether a self exists beyond the constructed self. But before we go into the ways your poetry plays with the constructed self and destabilizes the constructed self, I was curious if any of your science reading was science reading about the nature of self.
Mm-hmm. I've branched out from physics into biology and neuroscience and, you know, cognitive science, which is fascinating.
Yeah.
And so I know, I don't want to sound like I know a lot, but as many people do, that working memory is very short. So, you know, what can possibly be in your conscious mind is very limited. And there's a lot more going on in your brain and your body than you can ever be aware of. And yet most people identify themselves with, you know, this little flesh-lit area of consciousness. And I don't mean to say that that's not important, but it's also a kind of contrivance, I guess. It's a user illusion, that's a term from computer science, I think, right? The user illusion is how the user of a computer interfaces with the computer. You know, some app comes up, some icon comes up, you click on it. You have no idea what's going on actually in the computer. I mean, most of us don't. Well, it's kind of like that with our relationship with the world, too, you know, the way our brain reacts with the world and with itself. I mean, I hate to only say that the self is a social construct, because I think there's more to it than that. I mean, we're biologically composite. We're made of a sort of confederation of cells, all of which have agreed kind of to work together and to divide labor up and become a brain cell or a liver cell. But they all start out with the same DNA, and they all start out in stem cells, you know, being pluripotent. They could be anything. So, you know, they kind of teamwork, they divide up, and they're in communication with each other, you know, in ways that the conscious mind doesn't know, doesn't hear, except maybe sort of vaguely. So a self is a kind of colloquy, a kind of confederation in many ways. And then even if you just talk about the conscious self, that's complicated too, because how often is what you're thinking actually something that comes to you from the outside, either the remembered voice of a parent or what you heard in a pop song or a movie, or it's kind of a pastiche. And I'm not saying that there is no self. I'm saying that it's a complicated pastiche, and will is a small part of it.
I love that idea of the confederacy of cells that have mm-hmm. agreed to form a transient composite. Mm-hmm. And I want to talk about that in relationship to your poetics. You have this essay called Feminist Poetics and the Meaning of Clarity that I found very illuminating regarding your sensibility. And in it, you critique poems and poets that employ what you call a totalizing metaphor, ones that create an impression of clarity and order by suppressing anything that would disrupt the metaphor. You say, only information tailored to the controlling code is admissible. No second thoughts or outside voices are allowed. And I wondered in reading this if the constructed self is similar to the totalizing metaphor, constructing itself through omission and loyalty to a self-narrative, mm-hmm. a controlling code, and if paradoxically, by not working with a totalizing metaphor, by allowing second thoughts and outside voices, a poem might have more access to a contemplation of selfhood or its possible absence. I wondered mm-hmm. what you thought about that.
I think that's very interesting, and I think you're right. I mean, I really agree that the ego is a kind of performance, and that most people who think of themselves as, I'm a this kind of person, I'm a that kind of person, I'm an extrovert, I'm loyal, I'm honest, you know, that's true some of the time for anyone, and then lots of other times it's not. I had a therapist once who told me, for instance, that I was a perfectionist. Yes and no. And I guess yes and no is what I would say to pretty much anything, frankly. But, you know, in some ways I am. I'm a perfectionist when I'm working on a poem. I'm not a perfectionist about the state of my wardrobe. So we're all more complicated than our narrative of ourselves allows for, I think.
Well, let me read back to you a couple quotes that you've said mm-hmm. and just hear your thoughts about them in light of this. One of them is, asking a poet to represent the personal life is, paradoxically, to turn the poet into something other than a person.
Yeah. Right. I mean, to be a representative, even if you're being a representative of yourself or a representative, a spokesperson for a group, and there's certainly a time to be a spokesperson for a group. There are occasions for that. But anyone who's done that knows that when you're doing that, you're playing a role, and it's not equivalent to your full selfhood.
Mm-hmm. And another really fascinating one. Loneliness is a theme that runs through a lot of my poems. The very separation between I and me, a separation which is central to being a conscious subject, creates loneliness, I think. Can you elaborate what you mean about the separation between I and me and in its relationship to loneliness, but just in general also? What do you mean by that?
To be aware, you have to stand outside what you're thinking and look at what you're thinking. So right there, you're two people. You're the mm-hmm. person thinking and the person thinking about what you're thinking. Mm-hmm. And there's a kind of splitting there. You could probably think about what you're thinking about what you're thinking, you know. So, consciousness is just full of division and mm-hmm. splitting. Mm-hmm. And in a way, that divides you from your initial impulse.
You've said that your poems tend to put identity and agency into question, partly through what you call throwing your voice. Mm-hmm. and speaking from various positions. So can you talk a little bit about throwing your voice and how that works in your poetry?
Yeah, well, there's one of my older poems that starts out, ventriloquy is the mother tongue. I think, you know, we learn to speak from other people. Sometimes I still hear my mother's intonations in my voice. So we have to sort of recognize that. And I think I've just chosen to sometimes in my poems emphasize it by bringing in clearly outside voices. They're not always directly identified as such, but hopefully you can hear when a different tonality comes in. And the reader, I think often in poems, not just in my poems, should ask herself, what kind of person might be saying that? Because sometimes in my poems, it could be language picked up from the medical world or from the bureaucratic or bureaucratic language or, of course, scientific language. And it often is not introduced as a scientist says or, you know, doctors say, or it's just sort of, I just kind of come out with it in the hope and the faith that people will be able to recognize that sort of discourse.
Two things that people listening to the radio might not know about your poems if they haven't read them on the page. One of them is that they're often in sections,
mm-hmm.
and I wondered, and they're often tonally distinct, the sections, and I wondered if there were different sources or word banks that were informing these different sections. And then the second part that people might not notice is how frequently there are words in quotations and scare quotes, and which sort of calls question to who's speaking them and what relationship that speaker has to the word.
Mm-hmm.
It sort of puts you on unstable ground regarding these words.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about both of those aspects in your poetry?
Yeah, it's true that I think a majority of my poems have some kind of section breaks. Sometimes there are sections divided with an asterisk or sometimes divided with a number. And or even if there isn't that kind of device, there will be a sort of logical leap between stanzas and between sections. So the poems are full of spaces. And I think that the world is that way. I mean, that is sort of my experience of the world, is that nobody fills in the gaps for you. Nobody explains cause and effect for you. We're often just left with this impression and that impression. We have to figure out how to connect them, and we do. So I think I maybe duplicate that in my poems because that's what seems authentic to experience to me. I mean, there is, in fact, no narrator in, I think, any of our heads who says, now I am walking out onto the porch, now I am sitting down, now I see a plane in the sky and I have this thought. Some people write that way, but,
right.
You know, I don't. I just say what the thought about the plane was. I mean,
yeah.
That's an arbitrary example, but...
Well, you've said before that narrative is as natural as a sonnet, which I
yeah.
think is a good way to
yeah.
bring that in. And you've also mentioned... in that same essay, The Feminist Poetics sort of speaks to something that you just said, because you redefine for us and make strange again the word clarity.
Mm-hmm.
And you're talking about an essay of Lynn Hajinian's called Strangeness. And you say that clarity does not need to be readable because the world itself isn't readable. If we really think about it,
mm-hmm.
the world is not, the first thing we think about is not necessarily readability. But I wondered, when you say in this essay that you look for a different kind of clarity, one that is not about control but about attention,
mm-hmm.
And you describe it as one where the sensorium of the world can enter as it presents itself,
mm-hmm.
it makes me think of science, of like an empiricist.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see that in the way that you're trying to most clearly represent what your experience of the world is? So narrative isn't seem like the most accurate. So this polyvocal and disjunctive
mm-hmm.
approach is a mirroring for you?
Yeah, I mean, that when you describe it as empiricism, and I know what you mean, that sort of sounds as if I'm restricted to the imagistic, and that's not true, although I often do start with an image or with something I see, but I could also start with a voice or even with something from a dream. But what holds these things together is that they are things that rather suddenly intrude on my consciousness. There's that word consciousness again, but things that present themselves. So I tend to start with things that present themselves, and then how will I deal with that? So I never start with an abstraction. Students often ask me that. Do I want to write a poem about memory or, you know, whatever? No. I mean, something has to arise almost naturally, whatever that means, arise objectively. And then I begin to react to it and juxtapose other similar things to it or with it as a way of understanding it.
Hmm. Can we hear a new poem of yours, My Erasures, and also
sure.
New Zombie? And if you have any thoughts specific to those around the parts, the way the parts are juxtaposed or the use of quoted
yeah.
words,
That would be good.
Great.
My erasures. My erasures were featured. I collected debris to sell as crash art, crush porn. Say goodbye to Lonesome George, the last Galapagos tortoise. I was a pushover for the laws of physics. I pictured us as two seals hauled out on a sunny rock, the roar around us a matter of course. Yeah, I can talk about this one and where the material comes from, because there are sources for several of these sections. The first section sort of stands alone. There's an asterisk right after it. My erasures were featured. That's something that I read on a friend's Facebook post. Of course, many of my Facebook friends are poets, needless to say. And I like this guy and his writing, but, you know, that was a boast. We all boast on Facebook, though, in a way, humble boasts or whatever. So somehow that just struck me. I knew what he meant by erasures. It's a literary, it's sort of a, you know, experimental literary technique where you take a published text and take out most of the words and find some interesting words that are left and, you know, make that be the poem. And that's what he meant. But somehow I heard erasures with a kind of double meaning. I was talking about double meaning before, and I tend to be very attracted to it. And I started to think here about erasures as, you know, the sort of erasing of the natural world that humanity is doing. So that's the first line and also the first section. The second section, I collected debris to sell as crash art. Those are the first two lines of the three lines in that section. I actually heard an artist say, talking about his work. And I thought, that's interesting, but it's also sort of grotesque. Debris to sell as crash art. He said that, crash art. So is this, like, I think he was talking about debris left over from accidents, like car accidents, run out and get a piece, you know. So I just couldn't help but put that in a poem. And then I went on to crush porn because that's the next thing that occurred to me. I mean, I think it occurred to me because crash and crush sound alike. But shall I say what crush porn is? Or do people know? Or do you not want me to say it on the radio?
I have no idea what it is.
Okay, well, it's, and I don't know why I know, but I do. It's when masochists like to be stepped on by women with high heels. That's crush porn. So anyway,
and
I
maybe
just...
Maybe it's crash art, too.
Yeah, I sort of bounced from crash art to crush porn. Just sort of, I guess, pulling out the decadence of the crash art quote, but also just bouncing off of it, you know, sound wise. And then the third section. By the time I got to the third section, I had realized I wanted this to have something to do with extinctions. You know, that these erasures, my erasures were featured, was going to have something to do with the erasing of species from the earth. So I deliberately looked up species that have gone extinct recently. And one was the Galapagos tortoise, some kind of Galapagos tortoise, that they had given the last specimen a name, Lonesome George. So then I came up with, say goodbye to Lonesome George, the last Galapagos tortoise. So that's a sort of, I don't know, bitter bounce off my erasures were featured.
Mm-hmm.
But they all come from a different source,
yeah,
to some extent.
Well, maybe instead of reading New Zombie, you could read My Erasures again, because I'm sure people will hear it differently now that,
okay,
you've walked us through a little bit of it.
All right. My erasures. My erasures were featured. I collected debris to sell as crash art, crush porn. Say goodbye to Lonesome George, the last Galapagos tortoise. I was a pushover for the laws of physics. I pictured us as two seals hauled out on a sunny rock, the roar around us a matter of course.
We've been listening to poet Ray Armantrout read her poem My Erasures. So when you say you gravitate towards double meanings in a lot of your poems, is that what you mean by Cheshire poetics when you describe your poetics as Cheshire?
Yeah, I guess by Cheshire, I mean not only that there can be double meanings, but there can even be opposed meanings. Because, of course, famously, the Cheshire cat sort of points in both directions and then disappears. So I'm interested in double meanings because it always reminds us of what we don't know and what we don't see. First, we see or hear one possible meaning, and then we realize that there's another one lurking, maybe. The way I heard my erasures were featured, first as what this poet meant, a literary technique, and then in its larger potential meaning as the way that humans are erasing the world. That was like the second meaning, but it sort of came in behind and around the first meaning. And that's an experience that I like to duplicate, I guess, for the reader. Make you as paranoid as I am.
Well, I mean, in you walking us through my erasures, you can hear that some of the things are things you've overheard,
mm-hmm,
and that cause associations with other things that you've seen or overheard.
Mm-hmm.
They're found in a way and then juxtaposed or collaged, and then other things you've actually sought out. So
right.
we have a different connection of attention versus agency, perhaps mixed together.
Right. Or even, you know, written originally, like the last part, I pictured us as two seals hauled out on a sunny rock, the roar around us a matter of course. That is written in the usual way.
Yeah. Well, you said that you are most sincere when you're posing questions,
mm-hmm,
and least sincere when you're making assertions.
Mm-hmm.
And I was curious, if do you see the assertions that you make as the outside voices farther from self, and that they're more imported, even though we would normally think of an assertion as very close to self,
mm-hmm,
and that the inquiries are closer to you?
I guess that's true, but I just want to also add that I don't feel all that distanced from the speaker in my erasures. I mean, in a way, I'm satirizing the statements, the positions, such as my erasures were featured, but I don't really stand apart from that speaker because I'm part of humanity, and humanity is destroying the natural world. So, and you know, in a smaller way, I also might say something like, my erasures were featured in such and such a magazine. That's not an impossible remark for me to make. I'm a poet too. So it's not like I'm just saying, you know, the person who originally said this is a bad guy. I mean, I'm implicating myself and the rest of us as well, at least I hope.
But in some poems, you do have outside voices, which I think mm-hmm. are more clearly not mm-hmm. you. And I wondered if this question of sincerity and assertion versus inquiry is where we, or where your poetics and a sort of politic cross in your work. And what I mean is that there's a politics in valuing attentiveness over assertion to begin with, but also if the assertions that you make using thrown voices that are possibly farther away from who you are, that are less sincere, if you're interrogating these assertions,
mm-hmm.
And if that is partly what you mean when you say that your poems aim to undermine a voice of social control.
Yes. Maybe I'll read my poem Mother's Day. That really has a lot of sort of almost parody of social control in it. And it also speaks in a voice that's definitely not the way I usually speak. Mother's Day. I wring the last sweetness from syllables and consume it before you. I make sense like a scorpion, and the sun will be smitten. If I appear to address you while quoting an old text, I am indistinguishable from nature and therefore sublime. If I reveal myself mercilessly, what will I not transcend? Like God, I will leave an arc of implication.
Can you speak to certain lines or certain voices that came to mind?
Well, this voice in Mother's Day is a very, I mean, before I tell you what some of the sources of it are, you can tell, I think, that it's a very self-confident, autocratic, really, voice. It's a sort of threatening voice. It's a voice that has no shame, right? I ring the last, you don't know at first who this I is, but it's clearly not me. I ring the last sweetness from syllables and consume it before you. I mean, this is a tyrant, right?
Right.
This is a tyrant speaking.
Let's hope it's not you.
Yeah, maybe it's part of me. It's interesting that it's called Mother's Day. I really couldn't tell you why. That just occurred to me, and I couldn't get the idea out of my mind. But if I appear to address you while quoting an old text, I am indistinguishable from nature. Well, I was quoting an old text to some extent here. I was reading Revelations, and some of the lines, the part about the scorpion and the part that says, and the sun will be smitten, you know, that's from Revelations, right? So in a way, I'm kind of playing God here, channeling God. And except since it's called Mother's Day, one pictures, I think, probably a female speaker. So I'm just trying on the robes of absolute authority there to see how they fit or how they sound coming from a woman.
Well, you've also said, it's to just continue this line around a possible politics, you said that the poetry you value reproduces our conflicts and fractures and yet is held together in the ghost embrace of assonance and consonance in the echoed and echoing body of language. And I wondered if that ghost embrace, if that holding together, or that the cohering of oppositional forces is a modeling in a way of a different way of society could be.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's a bizarre way to look into.
No, it could be. I mean, that would be a kind of benign anarchy, I guess, you know, a sort of a willing associational group coming together that's unforced.
Mm-hmm. Well, so speaking of of collectivity and ghost embraces, mm-hmm. you're part of an ongoing project called the Grand Piano,
mm-hmm.
an experiment in collective autobiography. Can you talk about what that is? What is the project, and what do you mean by collective autobiography?
Well, the project is complete. There are 10 volumes of it, and it was written by 10 authors who were associated with the so-called language poets in San Francisco. When I was in my 20s, I lived in San Francisco, and I became friends with these people, such as Lynn Hagenian and Ron Silliman and Bob Perlman. And it was Barrett Watton's idea, actually. He kind of organized it. He was part of that group, too. And we wrote mainly about the years between, say, 1975 and 1985, as we remembered them from our perspective. So each of us, in each of the 10 volumes, there's a sort of a loose theme, but it's not very directive. And we each take it up from our own memory and our own experience and write a prose piece about it. So in that sense, it's a collective autobiography. Hmm. In mine, sometimes mine slips out of the past tense, and I write about things that are going on in the present as well. And I even wrote two poems for that that ended up in the books, and then in those books, and then later in my poetry collections, because apparently I can't write prose without slipping into poetry. But if you know it, for those of you who know that book by Virginia Woolf called The Waves, it's a little bit like that, with all of these overlapping voices coming in and telling what is at least partly the same story, but also a differing story.
And when you're writing your part for a given volume, are you aware of where it's placed? Are you writing in relationship to the pieces on either side of it?
Yeah, yes, we would know who would be before and who would come after. And we look before it actually was published, we read one another's and commented and sort of had, we all had input.
Well, I want to return to something you said earlier when we were talking about your upbringing and about evangelical philosophy and it being material and your parents being distrustful of metaphor. Mm-hmm. Because you're also distrustful of metaphor.
Ah, that's true,
but
isn't it?
but in a different way, I think for different reasons. In support of your discussion of a different poetics and a redefinition of clarity, you talk about Lynn Hagenian's essay, and she talks about the difference between metonymy and metaphor, where she says that whereas a metaphor relies on a code, one that preserves meaning and transfers it from one thing to another, metonymy instead moves attention from thing to thing. Its principle is combination, not selection. Metonymy is unstable, foregrounding interrelationship. And it seems like one key concept for the language poets was a move away from metaphor toward non-referentiality. But you've said before that you weren't convinced that language could be non-referential. And if it could, you weren't sure you were that interested in the results.
Well, that's true.
So I want to hear a little bit more about what sounds like an uneasy relationship for you around metaphor. Talk to us about it and what your thoughts are in relationship to what Hagenian was saying.
Well, I really think metaphor is inevitable. You know, you can't get away from it. You can and should be aware of its limitations and not be fooled by it. But I think, you know, all of our thinking is in some sense metaphorical. It's embedded in language, and it's just something that it's natural for human beings to do. The sort of dark side of it is that in metaphor, one term kind of subsumes the other term. You know, one self gets mapped onto another self, which is hierarchical in a way that can be bad.
Well, Steph Burt, when they were reviewing your book, was talking about the latest cognitive science, and I'm guessing you probably read some of it about what you just said, that metaphor is a fundamental part of our sort of ordinary conceptual systems, and they're called small spatial stories, so such as we make room in our schedule or to move up in the workplace. These are inevitable spatial stories. But you seem to, instead of avoiding metaphor, sort of exaggerate the metaphor
mm-hmm.
to point out the story that's in it,
mm-hmm.
the story that seems invisible and maybe is mapping and erasing.
Yeah, I think that's true. In order to question it and sort of pull it apart a little bit. Some examples of that could be the poem Accounts, which tries to deal with physics by coming up with sort of crazy metaphors, or Integer, which deals directly with metaphor.
Yeah, well,
to some extent.
Let's have you read Integer now. I think this would be a great time for it.
Okay. I think I'm just also going to say before I start that a lot of my work seems to deal with unity versus fracture, and metaphor tries to unite things. So anyway, with that said, and there are different voices in this too, so it hits on a lot of the themes of our conversation. Integer. One what? One grasp? No hands. No collection of stars. Something dark pervades it. Metaphor is ritual sacrifice. It kills the look-alike. No, metaphor is homeopathy. A healthy cell exhibits contact inhibition. These temporary credits will no longer be reflected in your next billing period. Dark meaning not reflecting, not amenable to suggestion.
We're listening today to Ray Armantrout read from Partly, New and Selected Poems, 2001 to 2015. When we talk about the totalizing metaphor and the stable self, and perhaps putting Newtonian physics on one side, and metonymy and polyvocal unstable self and quantum physics on the other side, it sort of returns me back to your conversation with the physicist Brian Keating. And at one point he was talking about the role of aesthetics in science, how some scientists thought that elegance in an equation was more important than whether the equation was correct. And then the two of you even discussed the belief that if something were elegant, that it might be more likely to be true. And this made me wonder about different types of poets and different readers of poetry, in the sense that I wonder if people who are striving for a controlling code, for a stable self that carries them from the beginning to the end of the poem, were possibly striving for elegance. If they were striving for a balanced equation, even if the equation wasn't true.
Ah, well, that's an interesting idea. Yeah, it was Paul Dirac, the famous physicist Paul Dirac, said that it's more important to have beauty in your equations than for them to conform to the results of experiment, which is, he believed that the experiment could be wrong, but beauty could not, which is a lot like Keats, right? At the end of Ode on a Grecian Urn, truth is beauty, beauty truth. And Brian was skeptical of that, and, you know, I guess I'm skeptical of it, although I think that if so many scientists or so many physicists especially seem to feel that way, they seem to feel that when their equations have what they call beauty, which is really something to do with not only balance but maximum simplicity, that then they do turn out to be to accord with nature more often than not. And then they'll even say kind of metaphysical things like nature finds the simplest, most elegant way. So that's a kind of faith. You know, there's a way in which physics, as opposed to biology, which is messier, as is cognitive science, physics gets sort of accidentally slides into, you know, a sort of mysticism, I think.
It was great having you on Between the Covers today, Ray.
Thank you. It was fun being here. You had such good questions.
We are talking today to the poet Ray Armantrout about her latest two books, the chapbook Entanglements and Partly, New and Selected Poems, 2001 to 2015. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Water is Life, Youth Speak Out on the Impacts of Fracked Gas Export, on Thursday, November 16th at 6:30 p.m. at Hevera Shalom in Portland. Water is Life will include a panel of youth from the Yurok, Hoopa, and Karuk tribes, traveling all the way from Northern California to share their perspective, and a video recently produced by the Klamath tribes in Southeast Oregon, in opposition to the massive proposals to pipe, liquefy, and export fracked gas through the Northwest. Again, that's Water is Life, Youth Speak Out on the Impacts of Fracked Gas Export, on Thursday, November 16th at 6:30 p.m. at Hevera Shalom, 825 Northwest 18th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Hats for the Homeless donation drive. From December 1st through the 15th, five Southeast locations will collect clean, new, or gently used hats, scarves, and gloves, and the folks at Zippity News will distribute them to local shelters. Dropbox locations and more information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Shocks of Sheba has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Saturday Market. Open daily December 16 through December 24 for the Festival of the Last Minute. Saturday Market offers handmade art, crafts, and other gifts created by artists from the Pacific Northwest and is located at 2 Southwest Ankeny in Waterfront Park. Information at SaturdayMarket.com. And by The Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at